This morning I will be reading from Mark chapter 10, verses 32 to 45 in the NIV version. They were on their way up to Jerusalem with Jesus leading the way, and the disciples were astonished, while those who followed were afraid. Again, he took the 12 aside and told them what was going to happen to him. "We are going to go up to Jerusalem," he said, "and the Son of Man will be delivered over to the chief priests and the teachers of the law. They will condemn him to death and will hand him over to the Gentiles, who will mock him, spit on him, flog him, and kill him. 3 days later, he will rise." Then James and John, the sons of Zebedee, came to him. "Jesus, teacher," they said, "we want you to do for us whatever we ask." "What do you want me to do for you?" he asked. They replied, "Let one of us sit at your right and the other at your left in your glory." "You don't know what you are asking," Jesus said. Can you drink the cup that I drink or be baptized with the baptism I am baptized with?" "We can," they answered. Jesus said to them, "You will drink the cup I drink and will be baptized with the baptism that I am baptized with. But to sit at my right or my left is not for me to grant. Those places belong to those whom they have been prepared." When the 10 heard about this, they became indignant with James and John. Jesus called them together and said, "You know that those who are regarded as the rulers of Gentiles lord over them, and those high officials exercise authority over them. Not so with you. Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant, and whosoever wants to be first must be slave of all. For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many."
All right, good morning. If you hike or you climb or you are in the mountains and you consult a route description, you're usually told two things. You're told the distance of the climb, and you're also, so for example, how many miles from start to finish the hike is. And you're usually told the elevation gain. So meaning from the beginning of the hike to the end, how many feet are you going to gain? And we read in our passage for today that Jesus and his disciples are on their way up to Jerusalem. And when Mark says up, he literally means they're going up. At this point in our story, Jesus and the disciples are somewhere in the Jordan River Valley. They're near probably the town of Jericho. That's where they end up in the next story. And Jericho is 854 feet or 64 feet below sea level. It sits 14 miles to the east of Jerusalem. Jerusalem sits up high on a mountain, 2,575 feet above sea level. So if you do the calculation, when you start below sea level and you end up at the elevation of Jerusalem, you've done 3,500 feet of elevation gain. And if you've hiked or you've climbed in the hills or mountains, you know this is a decent climb. And the challenge in my experience with that kind of climb is there's the physical challenge, but if you're leading a group, it becomes exponentially harder to do that climb, particularly with small people, particularly, for example, with people that are 3 and, say, 6 years old, sometimes older, who at points of the climb are frankly quite astonished that you ever thought this was a good idea to lead them up this mountain. So I find myself on these hikes spending a fair amount of energy and thought trying to figure out how do I, one, stave off mutinies, because once the mutiny starts in one child, it tends to spread. But also, how do I motivate them to get up that mountain? And I do a combination of kind of going ahead, hoping they'll follow, and then like leading behind. I've got these hiking poles. I kind of try to herd them a little bit. And sometimes we'll kind of have a huddle, have a pep talk, and I'll say, when we get to the top of this mountain, this view is going to be amazing. And there's going to be a Snickers bar on top. Usually it's the Snickers bar that is by far the best motivator. But I'm trying to get them up the mountain. I'm trying to motivate them. In our passage today, Mark says that Jesus is leading the way. He's guiding the disciples up this 3,500-foot climb to Jerusalem. And we read in Mark that the disciples and those following him are astonished. They're afraid. They're wondering, do we really want to make this climb? And so Jesus calls them in. There's kind of these two huddles in this passage. He calls them in for this first huddle, and he says, "We're going up to Jerusalem, and when we get to the top, I'm going to be killed." And that's the pep talk. And this is the third time in Mark's gospel that Jesus has predicted his death. He did it back in chapter 8. He did it in chapter 9, and now he's done it in chapter 10. This prediction has the most details of the three predictions. And we learn for the first time in these predictions that Jesus says, "I'm going to be handed over to the Gentiles." It's the Gentiles who are going to kill him. And this is significant. We haven't heard this before because for Romans, the way you executed non-Romans was by crucifixion. So Jesus actually up until this point hasn't said that he's going to be crucified. He's talked about it as in Mark chapter 8 that he's taking up one's cross, but he hasn't said, "I'm going to be killed on a cross." And there's a good chance it might be dawning on the disciples that when Jesus is talking about a cross, he's literally talking about a cross. He's talking about dying on an instrument of Roman execution. You can maybe see a little bit why the disciples are lagging behind, why they're a little bit astonished, why they're kind of probably kicking at the dirt, why they're probably trying to stall a little bit. But how is Jesus moving? Look at this. I mean, it's easy to miss this line, but look at this first line. He's leading the way. He's charging up the mountain. Jesus is resolutely moving up the mountain to the place where he will violently be tortured and killed. You really got to see this. Things are moving really fast in our story. Jesus now is almost completely consumed by the thought that he is going to die in Jerusalem. And it's no wonder if that's Jesus' mentality, if he's charging up that mountain with this on his mind, no wonder the fear and the astonishment is rippling through the disciples. This seems mad. This seems insane. So Jesus is marching to Zion, but he's marching to a really strange beat. What's the beat the disciples are marching to? Well, I said some of them we read are hanging back, astonished, afraid, but not the sons of Zebedee. Not the sons of Zebedee. The sons of Zebedee apparently along this climb have hatched this plan, and they catch up with Jesus at some point and ask him, "Teacher, we want you to do for us whatever we ask." Like, what a way to preface a request, right? "Jesus, if you can just sign your name right here on the blank check, we'll fill in the details. Just, we got it from there." How does Jesus respond? How dare you? What's wrong with you? Get back in line. No, he says, what do you want me to do for you?" They answer, "Let one of us sit on your right and the other on your left in your glory." So in Jewish custom, the person at the center has the highest honor. The next place of honor is to the right and then to the left. So, you know, in our minds, maybe president, highest, to the right, vice president, to the left, secretary of state. Powerful positions, positions of honor, positions of glory. And this is we have this interesting pattern in Mark's gospel where every time Jesus predicts his death, either, for example, in chapter 8, Peter just flat out rejects it. They just kind of ignore it like they're doing here. Or it just seems to go kind of in one ear and out the other. So again, we're going up to Jerusalem. Jesus is looking west to Jerusalem. And Jesus sees to the west a violent and shameful death. James and John are going the same trail. They're looking to the west to Jerusalem. And they see glory. And they see fame. And I think in some ways, James and John are probably act as a mirror in this passage. There's probably a lot more of us in James and John than I think we'd like to admit. I just happened to read this week about this. Somebody listed a statistic that when choosing among options like becoming a leader, helping others, becoming more spiritual, this is what they wrote, half of millennials, so kind of a little bit younger than me. Half of millennials said their generation's first or second most important goal is being famous. And then the same thing note said, when teenagers in the UK were asked what they'd like to do for their career, over half said they wanted to be a celebrity. Lest you think this is a problem just for millennials, I mean, look at our political landscape. It seems like positions of power in our country so often are populated by the people who are much more interested in grandstanding and their own self-interest than serving the people they represent. This hunger for fame, this hunger for power, this hunger for glory, this is not a new problem. And think about this for a minute. So sons of Zebedee asking Jesus this, I've mentioned at the beginning of this series and maybe one other time, we think that the content of Mark's gospel probably came from Peter's recollections. So Peter shared this with John Mark. And so think about it. Why would Peter remember this story? Well, think about it. Pretty much every time we've seen James and John in this gospel, Peter's with them, right? Like they're like the three amigos. This is Jesus' inner circle. So for example, when Jairus' daughter is healed, only three disciples are allowed to go into the room of Jesus: Peter, James, and John. At the Transfiguration, three disciples are invited to come up the mountain with Jesus: Peter, James, and John. So Jesus is at the center, one Zebedee brother on the right, one Zebedee on the left. Like, guess what? Peter's not in the scene, is he? Like, Peter's like vice president, secretary of state, like ambassador to Liechtenstein, I think, is maybe Peter. Like, no wonder the disciples are indignant. We read they're upset. How does Jesus respond? You don't know what you're asking. You have no idea what you're asking, James and John. Can you drink the cup I drink or be baptized with the baptism I am baptized with? In the Old Testament cup, we'll see this word come up a couple more times. Cup symbolizes often something that's allotted by God. This can signify joy or prosperity. Most often when it's used, it signifies God's judgment. It signifies Jesus seems to be using cup as a metaphor for his suffering and his death. Baptism seems to be a metaphor for, in a sense, Jesus is going to be plunged into calamity. So Jesus, can you take the suffering? Can you take the judgment? Can you take the calamity that I'm about to take on? Oh, yeah, we can do that. They answer so glib, James and John. Yeah, we can do that. And Jesus says, you will drink the cup I drink and be baptized with the baptism I'm baptized with, but to sit on my right or left is not for me to grant. Those places belong to those for whom they have been prepared. So James and John want to sit at the right and the left in Jesus' glory. Jesus says, no, those places aren't for you. But think about it. If you know Mark's gospel, when is the moment of Jesus' glory? When is the moment in the gospel when Jesus' glory is revealed? It's on the cross. Guess what? On the cross, one man sits to the right, and one man sits to the left. And Jesus says, you have no idea what you're asking. You think we're going up to Jerusalem and my glory is going to be revealed in power and might and strength, and you're going to somehow attach yourself to my coattails and share in that glory. You have no idea what you're saying. My glory is going to come on a cross. It's going to come through humiliation. It's going to come through suffering. It's going to come through weakness. You have no idea what you're asking. You want a crown without a cross. You want glory. You don't want suffering. And so he does. He calls them again. The second huddle of this trip. And he says to them, that's the way the world marches. The world marches to a beat where power is the preeminent value. Like, look at the pagans, for example. They get power and they use that power to lord over people. Not so with you. Not so with you. For you, the preeminent value in this kingdom is not power, but service. Like, think about how backwards this is. Think about how much the kingdom of God turns the world's ideas upside down. A king whose glory is revealed on a cross turns up things upside down, not just for Jesus, but all who would follow him. The way up, as we talk about, is the way down. The way to greatness is not lording over others, but serving them. The way to honor is not seeking honor for oneself, but bestowing it and seeking it for others. That's the way it works in Jesus' kingdom. Back in our church community in Illinois, we had this practice of eating a common meal on Friday evenings. And the meal would start with typically a song that was for the prayer, and then there'd be this little stack of cards that would come out. And everybody's name was on one of those cards, and so the person would start flipping through them. And if your name got called, you were on for dishes after the meal. If I'm totally honest, most of the time, one of two thoughts came to my mind. Please not me. I do not want to wash dishes tonight. There's a fair amount of dishes, quite a few people there. I really hope my name doesn't get called. Or a lot of times it was a Friday evening, I'd go into farmer's market on Saturday, had a lot to do. Is the excuse in my head for why I can't wash dishes good enough? So that was kind of two thoughts in my mind. But there was this one guy named David. And David was, he was probably about 80 years old at the time. He was one of the original members of this community, had been there from the very beginning in the early 70s. And David had an interesting life. One of his most interesting stories was when 1958, when David was in his mid-20s, he and a few other guys, anti-nuclear weapons activists, set sail from San Pedro, California, on a boat, on a sailboat called the Golden Rule. So at the time, the U.S. and the Soviet Union were conducting nuclear weapons tests, and David and the crew of three other guys set sail from California with the intent of making it to the U.S. nuclear test zone in the Marshall Islands to try to get in the way of atomic bomb testings. Like, just think about that for a second. That's crazy. They didn't make it. About a weekend, some strong gales hit him. David got so sick, they actually had to turn around and come back, but with a few of the other crew on the Golden Rule, eventually made it as far as Hawaii, and they ended up inspiring other peacemakers and other peace ships to follow. They actually helped ignite some public outrage against nuclear weapons. And the one thing I remember about David is that David never tried to get out of washing dishes. In fact, it seemed like if he wasn't called, there was a good chance he was going to end up back washing dishes anyway. And David had a saying, and he said this: work is love made visible. Work is love made visible. In Jesus' mind, service to others is love made visible. Service to others is how we make visible, how we make tangible Jesus' commandment to love our neighbors. So Jesus, again, he's saying, greatness in our kingdom doesn't come by lording over people. It doesn't come by getting people to do things for you. It comes by serving them. It doesn't come by seeking honor and fame for yourself, by seeking it for others. But why is that? Why is this such a great value in God's kingdom? I mean, we kind of take it for granted, but what's so great about service? This is the second time, just a few weeks ago, I preached a sermon where this was in many ways a central point of the sermon, where Jesus had huddled up his disciples again. Because the function of a servant is to give, and giving is the essence of God. That's who God is. God is a God who gives. It's in God's nature to give of God's self for the benefit of others. That's who God is, and that's who Jesus is. And when Jesus says, whoever wants to be great among you must be your servant, and whoever wants to be first must be a slave of all, he's not just throwing this out as some like nice saying to live by and to put on your wall and to look at a time. He's saying, that's what I'm going to do. So if you got your Bibles open, look at verse 45. Jesus is, again, marching up to Jerusalem, where he's going to be mocked, where he's going to be tortured, and where he's going to die. And this is where actually the next 2 months, I think it's 2 months, some 2.5 months, we're going to just rest in chapters 14, 15, and 16 in Mark's gospel. So we're going to spend a lot of time in this last part. But here's the question I want to at least throw out today. We're not going to fully answer it now or in the next few weeks, but why? Why does Jesus have to go to Jerusalem? Why can't he take a detour? Why can't he go another way? Why does he have to go to Jerusalem? And why does he have to die? And that is a big question, right? That's a big question that followers of Jesus have been meditating and reflecting and struggling with from the very beginning, right up until now. And we'll come back to this question in the coming months. But verse 45, it's one of the most important verses in Mark. And it sheds light onto this question of why. Look at it with me here if you got your Bible. For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. Let's try to unpack this. What's Jesus talking about? What's a ransom? We don't typically use the word ransom today. When the language of Jesus' day, a ransom was referred to a bail. So think about the payment that was paid to free usually either a prisoner of war or a slave. So it's the cost. The ransom is the cost to free a slave. And it would then release, it would secure their release. And Jesus is saying to his disciples, I'm the ransom. This death and suffering and rising from the dead that I keep telling you about, it's a substitute on the behalf of humanity. Go back to that question we were at last week when the disciples are so alarmed by what they're seeing and they ask Jesus, who then can be saved? And Jesus says, with man, this is impossible. There's nothing you can do to save yourself. So there's nothing you can do to free yourself in this position of captivity that we find ourselves in, enslaved to sin, enslaved to the power of death, enslaved to evil, and all the ways that ripples out into society. How must we be saved? Well, it's not the way of the rich man because he was following all the rules and that wasn't enough. It didn't even seem like it was enough for the disciples who had given up everything. Jesus still said, with man, it's impossible. You are trapped. You are enslaved. You need someone to step in and do something that you cannot do for yourself. And I'm going to do that for you. I'm going to be the ransom that's going to set you free. And not just for you, but for all of humankind. In other words, that impossible, like I'm going to be the one that makes that way through impossible. I'm going to step in and I'm going to give my life as a ransom. I'm going to sacrifice my life for your lives and for the lives of others. It's a powerful statement. You've probably heard this verse before, but I want you to see, sometimes it gets pulled out of context. This verse is in a very particular place. It's as Jesus is going up to Jerusalem. Why do we hear this verse here? I think it's really important for us to understand this as part of a larger conversation. Jesus is not saying, I'm going to go up to Jerusalem, I'm going to give my life as a ransom so you all can take it easy. He doesn't say like, hey, I'm going to climb this mountain. Y'all look afraid. Y'all look astonished. You're probably tired. Head back to Galilee, get something to eat. I'll do this thing. We'll meet up. No, look at the beginning of the passage. It says, we're going to Jerusalem. I'm leading the way, but you all are coming with me. Can you put up that first slide, Ron? I'll start reading. This is a quote from David Garland. I think this is a good quote. So just a little bit long, but kind of hang with me. David Garland writes this, the only way that disciples can possibly live up to Jesus' demands is to realize that he has gone before them, broken through, and cleared the way for others to follow. He is like the man who cut the path through the jungle for days in order to lead a group of prisoners back to freedom and life, and then died of exhaustion upon arrival. Such a person would have died for many, although this would not mean that the many simply had to acknowledge this theoretically or symbolically. They were with him on this march, yet he was the only one who was strong enough to open the way, and he died in doing so. I think that's a beautiful way to explain it. Okay, you can take that down. Where do you get the power? Where do you get the courage to make this climb up the mountain, to a place that you do not want to go? You do it realizing that someone stronger than you has already made a way. You do it that someone ahead of you has made the supreme sacrifice. That's what launches you up the mountain. Think about it. What is the supreme act of love? It's when it We can usually think of no other act of love more supreme than when one person gives their life for another. And we know this, Hollywood knows this super well, not because I think they spent a lot of time reflecting on the death of Jesus Christ, but because they know how to move you emotionally. Think about the scenes in movies that get you, that hit you in the gut, that move often to tears. It's maybe not as much as this first one, but it's Darth Vader sacrificing himself for his son Luke by throwing the Emperor into the Death Star reactor in Return of the Jedi. It's Jack Dawson giving Rose the entire door to float on in the freezing waters so that she can live and he dies in the Titanic. It's Lily Potter sacrificing her life for the life of her infant son, Harry, from Lord Voldemort and Harry Potter. It's Katniss Everdeen taking the place, substituting herself for the place of Prim in the Hunger Games. It's Boromir taking on the horde of orcs to protect Merry and Pippin in the Lord of the Rings and dying. It's Bing Bong sacrificing himself for Riley by letting go of the rocket wagon Inside Out. You might laugh at that one, but go back and watch the scene. It's a tearjerker. Those are the scenes that get us. Those are the scenes that hit us at a visceral level because they show us the ultimate sacrifice, because we know there is no expression of love greater than one person laying down their life for another person. And that's what Jesus is going to Jerusalem to do. And when that sinks in, that's what sends you up the mountain. That's what moves you out of the fear. That's what moves you out of the astonishment. That's what moves us out of being so consumed with our own interests to being so consumed with the interest of others. That's what moves us away from being so consumed with seeking honor and glory for ourselves and instead looking to seek and bestow honor on others. That's how we do it, because that's what Jesus did for us.